My name's Eric, and I'm an alcoholic. And I don't know how to do this at all, really. Plus the fact that, I mean, I've only just started being able to speak again because about 3 weeks ago I had all my teeth taken out and these implants put in. And so it all kind of feels funny in there. And I'm just trying to kind of overcome this lisp and a whistle, which you can hear. So, some of it is quite nice because I sound like people I used to admire, like Otis Rush and Ray Charles, who used to sing with a lisp. So that's cool. But one of the great things about this was that one of my dreads as a practicing alcoholic was dentistry. It was like a lot of other things that were really just not available to me. I had such a, you know, the dysfunctionality in my life was so pronounced that I didn't even see a toothbrush until I was about 18. You know, I was very poor stuff, all that raised with, you know, in a two up, two down, where there was an outside, you know, zinc bath and no bathroom. And so, but I remember being in class at school about 10 years old and the back of one of my front teeth fell off. I mean, and that's where a lot of my kind of disease started to kick in, because I started lying. And I think I'd really kind of developed the thing that, you know, Lauren and other people have talked about, that thing about changing the way I felt. I started changing the way I felt right then, and obviously before, because my teeth fell off because of sugar. And I started eating sugar. I mean, I can't even remember when I was probably 5 years old. Sugar on bread and butter. And that was like, I don't know, it was like a post-war thing in England. That's what you did. Poor families did that. They used to put sugar in milk too to feed the children, so that the children would drink the milk. And it was like, it was part of bad education, all kinds of just dysfunctionality. And so I was kind of set up. I was ready for this stuff. And there were so many other ways that it was coming into my life. I lived in a village in the country in England where we had this thing called the British Legion, which was like a veterans society, you know. And I would see the ground. We would, as kids, would be taken and we'd be stuck outside, put outside with a packet of crisps or whatever you call them here, potato chips and a Coke or something. And they would go inside and they would change. You know, the adults would change. And they'd go in kind of quiet and reserved and miserable. And you'd hear them changing inside into kind of happy, uninhibited, you know, gregarious people, and they'd be having the time of their lives, and then they'd come out, and then they'd be, you know, once they were kind of out again, and they'd take us home, there would be a shift back somehow, and it would be a little bit more pronounced, it'd be a bit more kind of aggressive and sullen, and, you know, it was kind of like, that was like a little microcosm of what my kind of drinking was like, that I would be, you know, just shy, withdrawn, terrified, fear-based human being who once I got something inside of me became, you know, anybody and was up for anything. And then as it started to wear off, I became malevolent and violent and aggressive and miserable and in the end, suicidal. And that's what brought me here. And I, you know, the one thing that you always, you know, that I go over and over in my head, and whenever I think about what I'm going to say at a meeting, is that apart from being blessed, you know, I wonder why I was chosen for this and why we get to be chosen. I mean, I wouldn't even think about how that affects you, what you think about that. But I know for me, I don't understand why some people don't want this. I mean, I've done some 12-step work where I've brought people to the door and I've seen them turn away, walk away. And I've seen others die, you know, deliberately die when confronted with the whole notion of getting honest and looking at their past and trying to do the work that is involved, and I don't understand why they didn't want to do it, you know, why we get to be fortunate enough to the miracle I'm talking about is the wanting. That's the miracle in my life, is that I wanted this enough to do the hard work. And I found it pain. I'm sure we've all found it pain. I'm sure the newcomers find it very, very pain. I can't even remember. I mean, that seems like a fog. Like there's a fog between me now and where I am. Because I know I was just driven by fear. And like, I remember coming to meetings trying to impress everybody with the fact that I'd been around for a while. So, You know, how does a newcomer do that? You know, I wanted everyone, it was impossible. I wanted to pretend like I'd done the steps. I wanted to pretend like I was, you know, 3 or 4 years sober when I was only 6 weeks. And the pain of that, you know, the pain of that self-consciousness, of the pain of asking for help, that to me was very, very hard work. I don't know anybody who seriously works on this program who finds it easy, because it's not supposed to, because it requires that we put one foot in front of the other. And the most courageous people in the world, in my book, are recovering alcoholics, the people that walk through that door. And on a date, and that's still the same for me now, you know, driving up here tonight. I have to hand it over. I have to hand it over to my higher power, because that's easy for me now. I just say, you know, I don't know what to do. Get me there. I mean, I pray about, like, each mile of the road that I'm driving. Get me there safe. Get me something to eat. You know, let the people be nice to me. Try to keep me from talking about what I think, you know, because that was a complete waste of time. And they all know, you know, we are, you know, it's like we're all kind of experts on one fucking thing or another. But so, and you know, and I just hope that he, you know, sometimes he answers most of my prayers. He got me here. It's like, I think it was Ted said that, you know, that whole thing about, you know, I'm paying back. So, because I prayed all through my drinking to be got out of every situation I was in, you know, to be relieved of this, to be got through that, and I'll never do it again, and I'd do it again, and I'd ask, and I was always delivered. Now, and that's the other thing, is why was I, and the thing is, you know, it really is none of my business. That's the kernel of it all, is that I don't think I'm supposed to know, and whether I think I'm supposed to know or not doesn't make any difference, because I'm not going to ever find out. You know, I don't think I will. It's only when I look back on the path that I've already traveled that I see how, when I've been there meeting that person, there's been some kind of connection where they meet another person that somehow brought to, you know, the program or something. And then I see that every girlfriend I've ever had, or every, you know, journey I've ever taken has been in order for me to do some. It's all about service. And the thing is that I can't govern that. I have no control over it, and really all I've got to remember to do is just show up, and the rest is done for me, because I don't, you know, the minute I try to figure out how this works, I don't need to come here anymore, and that's a frightening thought, because I know people that do, and I guess I know some that do, and it's like, well, I'm getting off on a tangent, and they turn into lecturers, and they turn into experts, And I'm not, that's not what I want. I like to hear people that are, you know, around a long time who still say, like, I don't know how to do this. You know, I don't know what, I'm frightened. Or, because then I know that they're human and I can, you know, because it's like I go back to that thing of authority. I can't be around authority. I need humility. I need humility as an example. I need to see that someone could stay sober a long time and not become authoritative, not become, you know, like a governing body, not become an expert, that they can retain their innocence, that they can be childlike and still be adults, you know. And that's what I find that here. I don't find it anywhere else. And I know there are great people out there without programs who just seem to be on the path, and I do meet them from time to time. But if I want to be guaranteed to that kind of exposure, I come to an AA meeting and I get it here. So, my story is very, very simple. I just, you know, I'm just the same as everybody else here. It got hairy. It got good. I crossed the line. It got nasty. And somewhere, you know, and I don't, you know, with that whole thing about, I knew for a very, very, very long time that I'd crossed that line. I don't remember crossing it, but I knew for at least the last 10 years of my drinking, I think, that I had to stop. And I would, I remember getting, waking up, coming to, and thinking, well, today is the day. I've got to stop this today. And I don't want to tell anybody about that, because I don't want to make any promises to anyone. So this is something I'm going to do on my own. And then when I've done it, I can say, but I'll just have a drink first to kind of like get the, so that my mind can function, you know. So that I can figure out how I'm going to do it. And, of course, the first one wouldn't even go down. It would just be reject. My body would reject it, and I'd be dry heaving, and then it would be like... And it was vodka, you know, was all it could in the end, I'm sure. Most of us know that one. And finally, the third or fourth one would go down, and then I'd go, I'd be fine. And I'd think, right, now, so what should I... How would I go about this? I don't know. I'll take the bottle down to the other room, and I'd move around the house, you know, postponing the actual whatever it was I thought I was going to do, postponing it until the bottle was empty, and I was passed out again. And you know, while I was doing that, I was thinking, well, this afternoon I'll stop, you know. And of course, this afternoon was gone, you know, and I'd wake up, and it would be dark, and I wouldn't know whether that darkness was morning or evening. I mean, I didn't know. I'd be at home, and I didn't know where I was. You know, I was, and I was married. I had a very successful career, and this has been a great thing for me in my journey, was being able to tell people that acquisition is not it. Because by the time I was 23, I was a millionaire with the gift that God gave me as a musician. I was making money without wanting to make money. I didn't know how to stop it coming in. And I tried very hard, believe me. And I would leave every band. The minute they thought they wanted to be on TV, I was gone. You know? There was some... I actually... See, the anonymous part of the program was very familiar to... Because somehow or another, I wanted that for me anyway. I wanted to be able to be good at something, but without anybody knowing it. But I did want them to know at the same... It was like that whole paradox of, I don't want you to know, but I want the kudos. And I had the madness, insanity even then. So, but the whole thing about that was that I didn't want to be rich. I didn't want to be successful. And as long as I had that going on, I could not stop it. And I'm sure, it's, you know, people that want money, want success, it just doesn't happen because there's something... It's like a paradox in there. But I do know that having all that stuff, and having a beautiful wife and a great home and a career that just shone, you know, no matter what I tried to do to destruct the whole thing, it kept getting better and better. And in spite of all that, at the end of each day, I was considering suicide. And now, see, that, how does that make sense? You know, that... And I know that there are people who probably come into this program without very much, who think that this is going to get them that, you know. And maybe it will, but for sure, along with it come a lot of other problems. And some of those things, I don't know if I'm ready for now. I mean, I'm still quite, you know, self-destructive. I mean, I do like to self-sabotage a lot. And I still practice that. I still kind of set about trying to undermine it, so that basically, so that I can survive, really, and retain some kind of anonymity. So for that part of me, I'm very lucky and blessed in that I did, for instance, have a fairly strong belief in God when I came here. That was not a problem for me, and I did want to be anonymous. So when people came up to me at meetings and asked for my autograph, it was easy for me to say no. You know, I'm Eric the alcoholic. And there was a time, I think, where there was definite conflict in it for me, that when I first got sober, which is a long while ago now, it was back in 1981, I went out on the road. You know, I went out on tour, and it sounded like shit. And I felt, and it was an awful experience. And of course, it was every, you know, I was in treatment, and everyone said, counselors and fellow patients alike said, you know, don't do anything. It's like that old thing. Don't do anything. Don't get involved with anybody. Don't make any decisions. Don't do anything for a year. And within 6 months, I was touring America on a massive scale, hating every minute of it. And being around very, very dangerous situations all the time. And really kind of feeling miserable. And I suppose, you know, I was on the way back, and I relapsed as a result of that. And in my, I went back into treatment, and in that period of time, being back in treatment, I had to confront. I was either going to come back here as an alcoholic, above all, or I was probably going to die. You know, and this was, I mean, I have it in spades. This disease, I really do. I have it on every level. I mean, I project all the time. I'm a fear-based guy. that, you know, shame. I go into shame spirals at the drop of that. I'm getting better, like Lauren said, I'm improving, but I don't do anything. I mean, all I do is I come to meetings and I pray that God will do most of the rest. I will try. I work the steps, but I'm very conscious of the fact that my defects are not really mine to control. I mean, I can't. I've never been able to. Like someone else said, I don't know how to hand it over. I still don't know quite how to hand it over, other than to try and help somebody else. You know, when I get into that predicament about self-obsession, I kind of got a little switch where I think, well, think about somebody else. Go and do something for somebody else. That's my way of handing it over, but I don't know if that's the right. I mean, it's the way I do it. But for me, it's tough, you know, and the thing about where I've had to work very hard is being, you know, having this kind of celebrity as a musician and being like on the media. And you know, and there's recently been a thing where I've put together a center in the Caribbean to help people. And I realize that that's not an AA project. You know, I've had to kind of really work hard on my boundaries around this stuff. Is that, you know, treatment centers, I'm not AA. You know, that's like they work with the 12-step program and they advise, but nevertheless, you know, and it's still a separate issue. And when I was confronted with these people that, you know, that I put together to make this thing work, they said, well, you're going to go out there and have to go out there. You're our only asset. Nobody knows this fucking thing is here. You've got to go and tell them that it's here. And you've got to, and in order to do that, what I said, well, what am I going to do? I go on 60 Minutes, do the Today Show. I do like all kinds of fucking magazine and newspaper articles. And in the course of that, I'm on the edge the whole time of breaking my anonymity. And that's been a real tough thing. And, you know, that's given me, that whole exercise gave me a great learning curve about how important my anonymity is to me. And it is really about my boundary, about, you know, how much I, because now I've got to the point where I love this thing we have. I love it above all. And even when I say that, I can feel a tingle coming through me because it's a spiritual thing for me that what we do and the way we help other people and ourselves in the process is not to be fucked with. It is not to be compromised. Yeah. And I've been, you know, and it's like, it's amazing how when people are faced with that, how it tantalizes people. You know, like, I remember my sponsor being involved in the kind of sort of business project where, you know, they had a long conference with these other people that he was involved with on some business thing, and it was all folding, it was getting crazy. And somehow or another, he sorted it all out. And after the meeting, one of these guys came up to him and said, you know, I don't know how you did that, and it was brilliant, but what's your secret? What have you got going on? And he said, well, it's nothing to do with me, and it is a secret, you know, and that was like, that's what it, and I love that, you know, that that guy, you know, he's got 20 years, and he is like a saint to me, but he's one of those guys that says, I don't know, I just go to meetings, you know, and I love that, but it is very difficult. I've had to do a lot of work going to talk to people in treatment centers, saying, like, you know, that primary purpose thing, you know, when we read the preamble, our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. That is my primary purpose. And I've had to be, you know, my primary purpose is not making sure this fucking treatment center works. My primary purpose is if I get the opportunity going in there and telling the alcoholics in there, the recovering people that want to stay sober, my story, not what I think, or not, you know, please get your other pals to come in because we need the money, you know. But seriously, just to be there so that they can see that I'm a guy with a load of money who's had a great career but who still occasionally thinks about suicide and, you know, although that got a lot better, I can assure you. But that is not it. That it is about peace of mind, which comes from other people, comes from our common welfare. And that's what I always rely on, you know, that in any given difficult situation, there's two options for me. One is to isolate and try and figure it out and eventually fucking self-destruct and go down the road that I've already traveled. The other one is to come here and ask you for what you did when you had the similar experience. And that's the one I've chosen most. And it works. And it is usually You know, I'll avoid people that try and, you know, proselytize or lecture or tell me what they think. I will say, well, tell me what you did when this happened to you so that I get the experience. And usually it is the simplest thing imaginable, you know. And that's what works. So that's it for me. I mean, I flew all this way to come to this meeting, and I'm really glad to be here. I had no idea. I remember actually driving up the coast thinking that about 20 years ago, I came up here to make a record at a place called Shangri-La, and man, is it different now? I mean, I don't know if it's still there, the place, but some of those guys are dead, you know. One of them's in, and this was a group called The Band, you know, that was a great band, and one of them hung himself, and he was like, we drank together. I mean, he was like a Grand Marnier freak. He drank Grand Marnier at the bottle, and I love, man, that's a man's way of drinking, you know. And he hung himself, and I've seen so many people, lost so many friends who didn't get this light shone in their lives, and which brings me back to that thing, is like God somehow or another chose us, and now we get to choose. And that's the other thing about this program that I love the most, is that I have a choice today. And like Lauren also said, I can look back and see that it's all been choice. And it still is, you know. I can choose. And I am responsible for my own happiness and for my own life. I am totally responsible today. I don't blame anymore. I try to still on occasion because I am an alcoholic. And I will always act in that typical way. My first response is usually to, you know, fuck it, it's his fault or her fault. And then I modify. And then I act. I act usually on the modification. For that, I'm really grateful. It's been almost 12 years for me, and I guess I've got another 12 to go before I'll have paid back my debt, and I hope a bit more, you know. I don't ever really think about this as being a long, long road. It's still one day at a time for me. I really don't make too many plans. I try to take the program to everything I do, the way I love, the way I live, the way I work. It's about spontaneity and being in the moment. And we're very, very lucky to be given this gift. And I'm very grateful for you listening to me tonight. Thanks. Thanks for letting me share.
A few days later, I'm right up the street here to 100 Center Street. We all know 100 Center Street from New York City. And I was physically thrown out of the court for exploding one day, again with the stinking system. Not just the stinking thinking involved in the whole thing, but the system stunk. Because here's an arresting officer who had planted this bag of heroin in the girl's bra, and now he is accusing her of this whole thing, and I just exploded. I was going around half shell-shocked anyway, most of the time. There wasn't too much rationality what I was doing, from one thing to another. But I exploded and told the judge off in his court. And nobody ever tells a judge off in his court, you know. There are two gods now, God and this judge. I used to believe there's one God, but so he ordered me out of the court. And as I'm being escorted out, one of the narcotic squad cops looks at me with real disdain. Junkie priest. Am I a pig? You know. So the Inspector Carey, does that ring a bell? Inspector Carey, in charge of the narcotic squad, sent another report into the Chancery office. They were getting a fire on me, and that didn't sit too cool with my church either. I was called down the Chancery office and told to leave the city. It was a crushing thing. I didn't know Darlene then, but I was always saying it's going to be all right, Lord. Just like Darlene would say, it's going to be all right. I didn't know how it was going to be all right, but it was going to be all right. I broke up in tears, and it was a crushing experience because now the sheep had no shepherd. Went up to, they couldn't send me any further. I found myself on a cliff, Newfoundland, running the retreat house. But I hardly get there, and I get a letter is forwarded to me by the American Medical Association to come to, of all places, with apologies, to come to Chicago and read a paper on the aftercare of drug addicts. The aftercare of drug addicts. Get it? The aftercare. So I said, oh, I'm safe now. I'm out of New York. So I go to Chicago a week ahead of time, and I say, well, before I can read this damn paper, and I spent a lot of time in the paper. They sent me the money, a train, plane ticket, cash to come and back, and they gave me a $500 check to give the talk. I said, oh, I had to get in this business of lecturing. So I went to Chicago a week ahead of time. I had laryngitis. And so I could really talk like some poor guy who was going through withdrawal. And I went from hospital, and I go through the whole act, and begging and begging and begging for some treatment. I realize now, since N.A., that hospitals treat. We care. You treat an abscess. You treat a sickness. You don't treat people. You care for people. But in Chicago, I went from hospital to hospital trying to get in. And they really thought I was an addict. And finally, when everything failed, I called the chaplain. I forgot the name of the jail in Chicago. And I said, well, I can at least get his number. How'd you get my number? What does it matter how I got your number? I want your help. He said, well, the only help is if you break a window, get yourself arrested, you come in, we'll help you to kick in jail. So 3 days later, I come to the convention, bigger than this, all these very professional-looking doctors. I stood in front of them for a moment, took my paper. It was a 15-page paper. I tore it up in 6 pieces and said, how the hell can I read a paper on the aftercare of drug addicts when you don't even have any care? There isn't a hospital bed in New York City in Chicago, that will take a drug addict just to be detoxified. So I tore the paper up. There was silence for a moment. And I threw the check, too, and walked off. Can you imagine the consternation? They all came and began to talk to me. Marie Nicewander walked up first. We were friends in the city. I used to con her, and she knew that I was conning her. When I used to be getting dolophine from her, now it's methadone, but when it used to be dolophine, and she said, congratulations, but you better get out of Chicago in a hurry. It seems that even as addicts, and this was always a mystery to me, no matter what hick town an addict is in any state of the union, you always seem, by some kind of negative attraction, to find drugs, to find each other. Well, the same way, no matter where I go, I always seem to be able to bunk into drug addicts. 2 days ago, I'm cutting back here for a shortcut to find my way back here, and around here, corner, there's two businessmen from up on Wall Street, the new breed of coke fiends who have... and up at Wall Street, you only have more intelligent reasons for being stupid. So I said to the, as they're rolling this thing, and I said, what's going to happen when you come down? What do you mean when I come down? Yeah, you can't stay up all the time. What are you going to do when you come down? But man, are you some kind of a nut? I said, no. I said, anyway, I always seem to run into them. Them, it's them now, not us. I had my first contact with N.A. again in the mysterious ways that God often writes straight, I say, with crooked lines. On the second floor of the women's house of detention, they used to throw around a lot of magazines and papers. I see stuck underneath a little four-page, I wish to God I had saved it, or we could have someday one of my dreams that there'd be an N.A. archives. It said something to the effect, if you are trapped by drugs and you've tried everything and nothing works, come to the Y on 23rd Street, 8 o'clock on Wednesday. I had heard rumbles about N.A., but I was just... I wasn't ready for the whole philosophy of it. I didn't know anything about it. And in those days, not too many other people knew much about it. We knew about AA. I had heard stories about a Danny Carlson, and that he was experimenting with having some NA meetings in Rikers Island, then they were being tried in the women's house of detention. But you know how it is when you're in the can, you'll use any excuse, you'll even go to religion to get out and get some cigarettes. And so they would come down, but we never really counted it as such. But in anticipation of the history seminar that was held here 2 days ago, I got in touch with the archives in the Salvation Army, and they pulled it out of their archives, a little account of a birthday party being held in 1952 of N.A., and it was a second birthday party of N.A., so that N.A. was functioning as N.A. 33 years ago here in New York City. I worry less these days about, you know, saying some things. As long as everything is all right with God. Somebody walked up to me before this and said, how do you feel? I said, I'm very scared. They said, why are you scared? I said, well, as long as I'm scared, God takes care of me, and he speaks through me. If I stand up here self-sufficient, then God leaves me alone. And the final analysis, it isn't too important where N.A. started, but the day that I walked into that meeting, I never, never saw a sadder group of sheep, a more seedy group of people, a more lost group of people, disheveled-looking. I used to hear the girls say the difference between a junkie and a user, or a junkie and I'm a drug addict, is that if you're a junkie, you never take a shower. If you're a junkie, you don't have a room. If you're a junkie, you're catting, you're sleeping any place. Well, this group looked that way. And so with the laws as they were before 1962, it was a felony to have tracks. It was a felony to be nodding. It was a felony to just to be a drug addict. And the narco cops could be outside and bust you on the way out of a meeting. We didn't have that sense, as you say, that we were not under surveillance. We were. So very, very few people came. And we never had anybody to emulate, to look up to and say, he's clean 3 years. Man, if you were clean a week. That was a great thing in those days. And so We never had, like at AA, you could be sitting next to a bank president or a bishop, you know. But never at NA. We all had prison records. The first girl I met, who I knew from the house of detention, before she died, she had 99 busts on her stupid yellow sheets. 99 busts. And these were the kinds who were coming to NA, but that's NA history seminar. This is a spiritual meeting. And I think I'm desperately trying to keep my own memories green, and maybe yours too. Maybe I'm trying desperately to identify with you so much that you will continue to accept me, because in a certain sense, I don't have anybody else. Not that you... And I, one of the reasons why so many of you had to go to Miami or California, because that stupid Rockefeller bill made it impossible for us to have NA functioning. And I think it's not just paradoxical, it's an act of divine justice that we're having this convention in this building that Rockefeller decided to build. You know, I got a little note to deal with reality that there's another speaker. and I... the other pages are about spirituality, and I never got to it. Let me get to it in a hurry. The last four lines of the song that we sang last night so beautifully, The Impossible Dream, struck me very much. I heard it first two nights before I was to leave the city. And I broke up, still willing to go into hell for a heavenly cause. I got to know Mitchell Lee, the man who wrote The Impossible Dream, and I was having lunch with him the day that he sold The Impossible Dream song for $2 million. $2 million. Hey! A song is a song is a song. And no song is worth the value of a person. I used to pass around a lot in the women's prison the old poem, unknown author, like the auction you had here. The poem, I say often, Lord, take my memory, my understanding, everything. Maybe he's taken my memory and I forget things. But the poem goes something like this. 'Twas battered, scarred, and the auctioneer thought it scarcely worth his while to auction off the old violin, so he held it up with a smile. What am I bid for the old violin, he said. Who'll start the bidding for me? $1? $2? Only two, going, and almost gone. From the room far back, a white-haired man came forward and picked up the bow, and dusting off the old violin, he played music like an angel sings. The people were quiet. The auctioneer cried, now what am I bid for the old violin? $1,000, $2,000, going and gone, said he. The audience cheered. The auctioneer said, what made the difference? The touch of the master's hand. And many a girl whose life is out of tune and battered and scarred with sin is auctioned cheap to a thoughtless crowd, much like the old violin. the night of shame, the bed of sin, the fix, and she travels on. She's going once, she's going twice, she's going, and almost gone. But the master comes, and the foolish crowd can never quite understand the price of a soul and the touch of the master's hand. The master has touched you. He's touched all of us as we understand him. It's a mystery to me how some of you can still fear God. How? Why? He says, come to me, all you who labor and are burdened, and I will refresh you. He never promised to take away the pain. That's structured right into life itself. And the only way to take away some pains is to take away life. But that's too precious. But that pain, that suffering that we all go through is the price that we must pay to be whole people. And this master touches us. There's an area inside of you that no cop can ever reach, that no trick can ever reach, that nobody can touch but the master. And he's touched you in a way that has no comparison on this earth. How you can fear a God who says, I will leave the 99 and search for you. And there's more joy in heaven over one junkie who comes back to him than 99 bishops that don't need it. Or maybe they need it, but don't know they need it. How we can be afraid of a God who has proven that he loves us so much, the proof is that we are here. Do you know what we represent here? We represent 15,000 years of drugs. We represent 10,000 years in jail. We represent $150 million a year in the negative aspect. And the fact that we are here is proof that God loves us. He once said, as I understand unto me, oh, how often I would have gathered you about me, even as a hen doth gather her chickens beneath her wing. But you would not. There was a time when we would not, because we were scared that he might. We were afraid to pray, for fear that he might hear it. The only prayers we knew, God, help me to find a good vein. God, I hope this is good junk. God, I hope they don't kick the door in. Whereas the girls used to say, Father, I promise to God I'll never take drugs again so long as Judge Stoneface isn't sitting today or something. The prayers. But anyway, may I just end with this? And I have six precious cards. Maybe I'll save for Chicago. I just... I fear how you're going to feel when the feeling disappears. I fear when you get back to your hometowns and this emotional high is gone. Please, feelings are not facts. You may feel at times like a bum, but that's not a fact. You may feel like a no good, but that's not a fact. Feelings are fickle, selfish, unpredictable. Feelings are dangerous. Facts are something you can deal with. This is why God, as I understand him, said his last beatitude, and people don't know it. Blessed are they who have not seen and yet who believe. We believe even though we don't see. And yet there are things that we can see that others can't. Blessed are the eyes that see the things that you see. And so when feelings aren't there, you can still be as close to God as ever in blind faith. Faith is not seeing. If you see, it isn't faith. Faith isn't hope. If you have what you hope, you're not hoping anymore. In heaven, there'll be no hope because everything we hope for, we have. There'll be no faith because everything we believe in, we'll see. All that remains is heaven, in heaven is what we went through last night and the night before, hugging and hugging and real charity and love. And you got it, baby. You got it. Hang on to it. I think I... I can end with this prayer that I pray with you and for you. Lord, my God, as I understand you, as I believe in you, I am freely living a new life in NA today. For too long a time, I wasn't a free or happy person. Drugs had cheapened and enslaved me. Drugs had imprisoned me far more than prison itself. I had no hope without dope. And so wishing to live, yet drowning in a lonely sea of despair, I cried out for help. Somehow I knew that I couldn't help myself. Neither could my parents, children, husband, wife, friends. So Narcotics Anonymous is now my lifeline. I must not, I dare not let go of it. Here in NA, with people who love me and understand me in the truest sense, I daily feel the life pains of struggle and growth, the life pains of a new life. For I now believe that these pains, shared and understood by others, is the price I must pay for the life that I came to NA to save. There is hope without dope in God in NA. The last line of this old battle hymn of the Republic is, NA keeps marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. N.A. keeps marching again. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory.
Thank God for people like Father Egan, the junkie priest.